Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me on the roundtable today, we have Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey there. Good to be here.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks. Happy Monday.
And Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Jake.
Thanks for having me on.
So 2026 started out to be just as newsy as 2025. We can't get away from the relentless news cycle, so we'll dive in. In cities all around Ohio, from Westerville to Cincinnati, people are protesting the death of Renee Nicole Good. Demonstrations grew across the U.S. last week and spilled over into the weekend after video footage showed an ICE agent shooting and killing a Minneapolis resident. Here at the Ohio Statehouse, people gathered this weekend. Was anyone covering that, or did you, you know, read up on it, that what happened at the Statehouse this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, my colleagues were there and talking to individuals, both the Statehouse and then also just other events. Like, there was one in Clintonville on North High and North Broad Street. My colleague, Danae, talked to individuals who said that they just wanted people to have more empathy, and the country is built on immigrants, and that is kind of that priority. Certainly, there are people who take the opposite position, that ICE is doing an important job in enforcing the country's immigration laws. So an interesting conversation that is certainly not new, but is certainly coming to a head because of these, you know, this ICE shooting.
And early last week, Linda Hobson of Hilliard told WOSU News why she showed up to one of the protests that were in the city. She called it, quote, the insanity of this administration.
Deploying these soldiers and ICE all over against our own citizens, I just find it to be outrageous and horrifying and completely against what the United States stands for, in my opinion.
The way these protests are spreading and multiplying, it does remind me of the early days of the George Floyd demonstrations. Obviously, that grew into a worldwide movement. I'm not saying that this necessarily will. But, Jake, any thoughts on how this might reverberate in the coming weeks and months?
Boy, I just think it feels like it's just triggering. Yeah, I mean, 2020 does feel like it's in the air. I saw there were some issues with unrest in Minneapolis and some, you know, protests that sort of just got out of control. That anger is there, and I think that a sense of futility when you see, like, these federal agencies, that these whole local governments, you know, mayors are saying we don't want them here, police chiefs are saying please follow the law when you're here, and ICE is sending signals like saying locals have no jurisdiction to investigate us when we're here, like in this specific instance. So I think that this is sort of just like that futility and that anger fusing together.
Vice President J.D. Vance and the rest of the Trump administration is saying it was self-defense, a justified shooting. They released video on Friday that came from the actual agent's phone, who was the one who did the shooting. And in a press conference at the White House, Vance said that Good hit the officer with her car. He asked for prayers for the ICE officer who fired the fatal shot. He also said that Good's death was a tragedy, quote, but a tragedy of her own making. And he painted her as being brainwashed and a part of the left-wing network. Sarah, what do you make of Vance's prominence on this subject? I mean, he rarely speaks from the White House like he did in this case.
Yeah, it's tough. I think first, especially with the administration's, argument that Renee Good was using her car as a weapon, I actually think back to the Takiyah Young murder and Officer Connor Grubb, that was in Columbus,
here in
Ohio.
In a Kroger parking lot.
Yeah, and a very similar situation where someone was, you know, behind the wheel, officer shot, she was shot dead. And so, you know, that was actually what I went back to, because there's so much analysis that happens of the video and every second, and if the wheels turned a certain way and these things happen so quick. And then you've, of course, got people online rushing to say, well, the law enforcement officer was justified because of XYZ, or he wasn't because of XYZ. So everyone becomes like suddenly a professional video analyst, which I think is fascinating. But I mean, I think this hasn't happened in a vacuum. There have been, like Jake pointed to, you know, growing frustrations among local governments and even some state governments, I wouldn't say Ohio as much as like Minnesota, at the presence of federal law enforcement, of Border Patrol, and also of National Guard members. Because, you know, there have been different cases of the Trump administration kind of, you know, sending in one national law enforcement body or another.
And Jesse, just back to the J.D. Vance issue a little bit. I mean, he's speaking out a lot about this. As someone who's covered him or watched his political rise a little bit, do you see it? Is he making a political transformation here, or is he just taking the moment to talk about it?
I think J.D. Vance has really been like a spokesperson for the Trump agenda. And so this is the Trump agenda, that immigration, more immigration enforcement is important. You also saw J.D. Vance during the campaign, not to like go back to the whole Springfield debate, but, you know, talked about Springfield quite a bit and immigration through the lens of like a local situation. A lot of that was hyperbole and, you know, discredited information. But he has been focusing on immigration influence on local communities for quite some time now. So I think that's one thing. And I also think, you know, he's considering or, you know, pursuing a bid in the next presidential election. And so it is to his benefit to be out front on issues generally.
You are listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We will leave that national news there and now head to some news that all seemed to happen all at once last week here in Ohio. Both major party candidates for governor revealed their lieutenant governor picks within hours of each other last week. Republican Vivek Ramaswamy, a first-time statewide candidate, picked Senate President Rob McCauley. The move prompted Governor DeWine to finally endorse the GOP ticket. And then Democratic candidate Dr. Amy Acton picked the former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, David Pepper. So, Jesse, back to you. DeWine said in December that he was having discussions with Ramaswamy and he hadn't endorsed him yet. Any idea what transpired in those discussions to make him, you know, decide last week to endorse?
I think Mike DeWine has been really interesting on this topic because Vivek Ramaswamy was never his first pick to be his successor. He certainly John Husted was someone who was his running mate and then lieutenant governor, who has been kind of primed for this position. And then we all know J.D. Vance won the vice presidency with President Trump. And so that spot for the Senate race opened up. It also became clear that Husted was going to face a primary in the governor's race if he kept going on that route. So, and then even in picking Jim Tressel as lieutenant governor was someone that Mike DeWine was kind of floating or casually supporting for governor instead. And so coming finally to Vivek Ramaswamy at this point, he was always going to endorse the Republican candidate. Mike DeWine is a Republican. He supported Trump in 2016. So this is just who he is politically. But so he was never going to like pick Dr. Amy Acton, someone who he did work with pretty closely during the COVID-19 pandemic. But it was interesting to do it now when Ramaswamy picks a kind of more establishment, you know, someone who has been in politics for a little bit longer. So I don't know if that assuaged any of his concerns about the newcomer, or this was just the moment to do it.
DeWine had this to say when he made his endorsement last week.
Whether it's the president picking the vice presidential nominee, or whether it is a governor picking the lieutenant governor who he's going to run with or she's going to run with, that's the first big, big pick. That's the first big decision that person has to make. And I think Vivek Ramaswamy hit a home run with this.
Sarah, to DeWine's point, picking a lieutenant governor is a big deal. Is it?
So I think
no offense to lieutenant governor, but is it?
I think for DeWine, I mean, if you look at DeWine's political career, he's been in politics for a long, long time. He's, you know, kind of privy to tradition, I think that in this circumstance, you know, when I was in that gaggle when he said that, he was asked about why he endorsed Ramaswamy, and he said a lot more about Senate President Rob McCauley than he did about, you know, gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. So I think, to Jesse's point, I think the tradition of it, picking someone who's more tapped into the legislature, has served in public office, whereas you look at someone like Mike DeWine, who has held pretty much every public office available to him in Ohio, whether that's a good or a bad thing to a person. Ramaswamy's coming in as a more Trump-style candidate. He's never held public office before. So I think to DeWine, it's a very important decision. Jury's still out onto the electorate if it's going to matter that much. And really quickly, I did just want to fact check myself, not to go back to the last story. Connor Grubb was acquitted, so I shouldn't say murder. Language is really important.
Okay.
The killing of Takiyah Young.
Yes, yes, he was found not guilty. Yes. Okay, so Jake, Rob McCauley, Senate president, do you feel like Ramaswamy was vetting a lot of people, or was it pretty much going to always be him?
I don't want to speculate that which I do not know here. I don't know what Vivek is thinking. I could tell you what he got in Rob McCauley, and Rob McCauley is not, he's not the person you see on the news making outlandish insults. He's a lawyer by trade. He's more like someone who's on the JCAR, whatever JCAR stands for, the Joint Committee on Agency Rulemaking and Review. Someone can fact check me on that one. But this is a technocrat. This is someone who knows how the state government works, knows how the levers of power work. This is someone who has run campaigns in Ohio and who has relationships with big political donors, with power brokers in the state. So I think his choices were someone like that versus someone who's more of a bomb thrower type. You know, Vivek is a very colorful character. He could, you know, like, the job is kind of what you make of it. So I think there's a lot to read into what Vivek was looking for here.
So Ramaswamy views McCauley as the key to pushing through his goal to lower income and property taxes. Here's what he said.
It will require me as a governor to work with our legislature to quickly, rapidly, surgically, unapologetically enact this vision.
Do you feel, Jesse, maybe Ramaswamy doesn't know how to work with the legislature? I mean, he's never held office before, so he needs Rob McCauley to do all of the backroom deals.
It's hard to say, but I will say it doesn't hurt to have someone who's led a legislative body in your corner when you're trying to pass legislation. Certainly, Mike DeWine leaned on John Husted, a former House Speaker, in that role. And so Rob McCauley has those connections. He has worked with these people. He has campaigned for these people before serving in the Ohio Senate. He was in the Ohio House of Representatives. So he has those relationships. And even things like conference committees and legislative service commission reports. Like, there's a lot of just really technical elements to passing an agenda that are not that sexy, but if you've been in a position like Rob McCauley, you would understand.
Sarah?
And I think policy-wise, too, like, Vivek Ramaswamy has been talking a lot about eliminating the income tax. McCauley was, and the Senate were, really big on flattening the income tax this budget cycle. So I think, you know, Ramaswamy's now got someone, he's tapped someone who has already, you know, achieved kind of a step to something that he really wants to see done. I mean, the Senate was the big body pushing for flattening that income tax.
And Jake, McCauley is term limited, and he's already served in the House, and he's only 41. So is this a logical political move for him? He needed somewhere to go, right?
Sure, yeah. And I mean, it's logical for anyone. I would love to be lieutenant governor. If anyone calls me, I'd be happy. Sure, yeah. What do you have to do? Well, something interesting.
Wear a sweater vest and talk about fitness, right?
Well, you say that as a joke, but the job, I mean, if you're the vice president, at least you break ties in the Senate for the Congress. I don't know that that's even – does the LG have any tie-breaking function? To my knowledge, no. So it's an even less in terms of just the espoused duties of the job, it's a less important job than the vice president. So if you want to go in and you want to go do push-ups in front of high schools like Lieutenant Governor Tressel, go ahead. If you want to take the John Houston approach and you want to like really embed yourself with the Chamber of Commerce mm-hmm. and like really be the business guy in the administration, go for it. So great gig. If anyone's hiring, I have a man.
Great gig
talents.
If you can get it. All right. Well, let's turn to the other person who wants that gig. Turning to the Democrats, Dr. Amy Acton picked David Pepper, who is known in Democratic circles for his time as the chair of the party. He's also a novelist. He has an online following boosted by his explanatory videos where he uses a whiteboard to explain things. He has run for state office before, but was never elected. Am I correct? I'm not good on my David Pepper history, Jesse.
Yeah. So a lot of David Pepper's elected official success came in Cincinnati. He was a city councilman and he was a Hamilton County commissioner back when Cincinnati was less Democratic. So you did have to like kind of work with both sides of the aisle. He ran and lost a race for Cincinnati mayor to Mark Mallory, who is a kind of a well-known figure in that area. And then he ran and lost races for state auditor and then Ohio attorney general against first Dave Yost and then later Mike DeWine. So his last statewide political race was in 2014. And really in the years since, he's been a party figure, a behind the scenes figure, kind of a political booster, you know, someone who is trying to recruit people to various offices. So he really hasn't been on a ticket for more than a decade.
Social media reaction I saw was mixed. There are some people blaming Pepper for losing the state to Republicans, not fielding competitive Democrats in these statewide races over the years. Sarah, is that a fair criticism or is this just people like trolling?
Well, I was going to say I'm really wary of like reading too much into any social media like
but
response.
It's so fun. It's so fun sometimes.
You know, I'm actually working on a story about this Miami University study that looked into like social media bots and how effective they were at like influencing the 2022 electoral campaigns. So I've become a lot more skeptical because it is, you know, what does the average person who's maybe not tweeting every 5 minutes
think about
David Pepper or Rob McCauley?
I would argue they probably don't think about David Pepper.
But that is a fair point. I do think that, you know, Pepper left the statewide party after a pretty bad election cycle for Democrats. Democrats have had pretty bad election cycles statewide in most races in the last few cycles. So I definitely think he has his work cut out for him to explain that. But I mean, I don't know. I think it's, again, it goes back to how much does the average voter care about the running mate on the ticket, especially in a governor's race. Mm-hmm.
Can I give a pro-con on that? Because it's an interesting argument. I mean, sure. I don't take too much stock in social media criticism, but the thought is interesting. On the one hand, yeah, I mean, Ohio, pretty bleak outlook for Democrats. There are none at the statewide level. There's one remaining on the Ohio Supreme Court. Jennifer Berner is up for re-election this year.
And everyone wants that seat.
a lot of that happened under David Pepper's watch, unmistakably. But I think that his biggest success was at the Supreme Court, actually. You know, and this was when it was ostensibly a nonpartisan, really on in terms of what appeared on the ballot, it was a nonpartisan race. It was commonly understood to be a partisan race, masquerading as a nonpartisan race. But in any event, Democrats had 3 seats on the Supreme Court on a 7-seat bench. So when you look at where, you know, you look at how Ohio has behaved politically, state went for Obama, went for Trump in huge numbers for 3 elections. That's pretty similar to like what happened at West Virginia, Kentucky, a lot of nearby, you know, in these some of these Appalachian states. So like I'm loathe to put.
You're saying it's
much.
Not all David Pepper's fault.
Yeah, there's clearly something structural
not saying it's all David Pepper's fault, but I'm saying the statewide chair is often the one who takes the blame, whether it is their fault or not. Same on the Republican side, just not in Ohio because Republicans keep winning.
But if we look at the action reaction a little bit here, Democrats have this really big success. I mean, they really have these 3 plum seats in the Supreme Court, and the Republican controlled legislature responds by changing the rules, adding partisan affiliation. And then now we're down to 6-1. And I think it's, more likely than not that it'll be 7-0 in November. Maybe I shouldn't make that assumption on air. In any event.
Well, you just did.
In any event, I think that there's some evidence that David Pepper performed well in the Supreme Court races and the legislature took notice.
So following the announcement, Acton and Pepper gave a one-on-one interview with Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And Acton said she was thrilled. Pepper accepted her offer. There's so much work to do. Here she is.
To solve the problems of everyday life for Ohioans. Ohioans are struggling, they're doing everything right, and they can't get any breathing room. And it's time that we end the special interest takeover of the State House and get good public servants. Quite frankly, we need them on both sides of the aisle.
Well, and we're out of time in this segment, but I wanted to quickly squeeze in the lieutenant governors. Here is Rob McCauley taking a shot at Amy Acton related to the COVID shutdown.
Ohio needs somebody who knows how to grow the economy, not shut it down.
And David Pepper alluding to the House Bill 6 scandal.
You pick the guy who's the president of the Senate of a state house that always is getting in trouble with corruption. That's not a change candidacy.
Do you think that Pepper and McCauley may be the ones who argue against each other as opposed to Acton and Ramaswamy, Jesse?
I don't know if you met Vivek Ramaswamy, but I think he can take his own arguments. And I think Amy Acton can as well. But I think you want people on your ticket that are going to pull in the same direction and be able to amplify your message.
Anyone else have any thoughts on, you know, the attack? Basically, they're attacking two different crises we've had. So it's like the COVID shutdown versus the House Bill 6 scandal. Sarah?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see, you know, how, I mean, there's still a lot of time left in this governor's race, even though it feels like we've been talking about it since the last governor's race. You know, it's only January.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there aren't, you know, real, I mean, there are primary challengers out there, but, you know, Ramaswamy and Acton appear to be the front runners in the race. So we're going to be listening to a lot of this until November, I imagine.
Well, I will say one quick addendum. We talked about how Rob McCauley was bringing kind of connections to the Ramaswamy campaign. David Pepper came from a prominent political family, you know, well off in the Cincinnati area. And then just from his time as being chairman, has a lot of connections there as well. So I'm sure that weighed into Acton's decision.
Yeah. Well, Ramaswamy and Acton are both kind of outsiders. And so they both picked two insiders. Right. All right. Well, this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up, Congress subpoenas Les Wexner, and there's new measles cases and flu hospitalizations are climbing. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us in the studio, we have Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman, Jesse Ballmer, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. There was news last week that a former bodyguard for the family of Vivek Ramaswamy was arrested on drug trafficking charges. Jesse, what more do we know about Justin Salisbury, who he worked for the Ramaswamy security team, and he and his wife, Justin Salisbury's wife, Ruth Ann, were both arrested, and she was employed in the Urbana schools. Do we know how recently he was working for the Ramaswamy family?
Yeah, so I don't have like a specific date, but I believe recently we saw photos of him at recent political events and have been kind of, you know, shared as well. So Justin Salisbury and his wife, Ruth Ann, were accused of receiving 261 parcels of suspected narcotics through the mail between August of 2024 and December of 2025. So this investigation wrapped up pretty recently. He was arrested, and at least as of late last week, was in the Franklin County Jail. facing federal charges because of this being through the mail. U.S. Postal Service is kind of a federal offense. He worked for an agency called ARC Protection, which had provided security for Ramaswamy's family for quite some time. And the campaign, you know, said that they were, you know, surprised by this disturbing news and shared a little bit about just like his past employment background checks and drug screenings.
So basically the campaign saying we had no idea, and obviously he doesn't work there anymore.
Yes, he does not work there anymore, and is not going to be a security guard for the Ramaswamy campaign going forward. In a statement, the spokesperson said that the family was alarmed to hear this disturbing news. They also said that ARC, the agency that was employing him, had that this individual had cleared multiple background checks before taking the job, and that they did pre-employment and random drug testing and had not failed a drug test. So we'll see how this plays out. Obviously, these are accusations. I assume he's going to plead not guilty.
Did you have something to add, Jake?
All I'd add is the thing that struck out to me in the story. It's sad that we live in a time where political candidates have bodyguards. Like, that's...
It said that he was a bodyguard for both Ramaswamy and his wife. So Ramaswamy's wife needs a bodyguard.
Vivek is a person of means, but like I'm sure a security detail is very expensive, and you don't spend all that money unless you feel threats to your life, or at least you feel threats to your life, however real or not. And that's just a sad thing in what's supposed to be a war of words and ideas.
That's interesting, Jesse. Do you think the wife of a candidate for governor in Ohio would have a bodyguard?
I mean, I think to Jake's point, I think it's concerning that people feel their safety. I mean, reasonably feel their safety is at risk campaigning in elections in Ohio. It's worth noting that the acting campaign also has security guards. So this is not specific to the Ramaswamy camp, but... Yeah, I think there's been enough evidence of political violence as of late that it is probably, unfortunately, necessary.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to another story. The U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform has secured subpoenas to seek testimony from New Albany billionaire businessman Les Wexner in the Epstein case. Who has been following this? Has Wexner replied? Will he comply? I guess Les Wexner's going to Washington.
So I think we don't have those details quite yet. This came out, they obtained subpoenas on January 7th, so really just last week. And they wanted to just find out more about the billionaire benefactor, Les Wexner, who has been tied to Jeffrey Epstein for quite some time. Epstein was, you know, his financial advisor. Like, they were close both personally and professionally. And so there have been numerous instances where they've been tied together. There have been allegations about, like, incidents happening on property either owned or, you know, tangential to Wexner. And so I think it's not surprising that Congress wants more information about this. It's interesting that there is kind of at least enough bipartisan support to move forward on it.
Democratic Representative Robert Garcia told Politico that Congress is compromising and, quote, "I think for us, the Les Wexner subpoena is at the center of this investigation," which I found fascinating. Wexner and his attorney have long claimed that Wexner cut ties with Epstein back in 2007. But then the documents that were released at the, you know, right before the holidays, it showed that those two were in contact in 2008. So, Jake, you know, Wexner's name is all over Columbus, all over New Albany. Do you think how closely will this testimony be watched up on Capitol Hill by movers and shakers here in Ohio?
Well, you asked an interesting question of how will he even respond to the subpoena? Will it actually get him to Congress? There have been, Steve Bannon was convicted for and served prison time, I believe, for refusing to respond to one of the subpoenas. Peter Navarro was convicted for refusing to respond to a subpoena. Mm-hmm. I believe he was pardoned, which is just another X factor in the minefield here. And if he does get in, I think that there's just this fascination is maybe a glib word, but someone like Jeffrey Epstein, this bona fide monster, was able to rely on his relationships with some of the most influential and wealthy people in the world, people like Les Wexner. And I think you know, it's tempting to always reject the conspiracy that there's this, like, cabal of elites.
My apologies.
out there. And I think the questions that they want to ask of Les Wexner point to this idea that you can sort of shirk these, you know, some of these laws aren't really for the mighty. And so mm-hmm. I think, yeah, we have people would really like to know, why are you making these statements that you cut ties with this man when you have not cut ties with this man? What mm-hmm. is the nature of your relationship?
Yeah, Jesse used the phrase, billionaire benefactor. That's what Robert Garcia called him, right? So, well, mm-hmm. He is a billionaire. We'll see how much of a benefactor he was, I guess, in the testimony.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, Wexner was founder of the L Brands, previously included Victoria's Secret, Abercrombie & Fitch, Bath & Body Works. He stepped down as CEO in 2020, but his name is everywhere across mm-hmm. Columbus, certainly has very influential and as a donor. Ohio State has plenty of things with Wexner's name on it. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting if there is any repercussions in just the public relations world for him.
Mm. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. You're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking with Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Three Ohio Republicans, Representatives Max Miller, Mike Carey, and Dave Joyce, were among the 17 House Republicans who joined Democrats to extend enhanced Affordable Care Act tax credits for another 3 years. This goes against Speaker Mike Johnson's objections. It goes against President Trump. Was this a surprise that this got through the House, Sarah? What do you think about the House passing these Affordable Care Act tax credits?
I don't follow, you know, the U.S. House as closely as I follow the Ohio mm-hmm. House and the Ohio Senate. But of course, you know, Congress has not passed like a full budget, like a full slate of its budget in a very long time. And there's a deadline ticking toward the end of the month, I believe, to either avoid or head into another government shutdown. Mm-hmm. The last shutdown was over these ACA subsidies and, you know, the issue hasn't been resolved yet. So I'm not really terribly surprised that some Republicans are at this point moving toward extending them because there hasn't really been like a, you know, both sides are arguing a lot about healthcare. Republicans are generally pretty anti-ACA, anti-ACA subsidies. You know, you hear from someone like Senator John Husted who says he'd be okay with like an extension, but Congress needs mm-hmm. to find a long-term solution to the country's healthcare woes. But Republicans just really haven't presented that long-term solution yet. So, you know, I think the short term is extending the subsidies and avoiding another government shutdown.
And this certainly is not a done deal, though, because the Senate is unlikely to go along with this. Senator Bernie Moreno is working on a bipartisan plan, a compromise to restore the subsidies for 2 years with some reforms. Jake, any idea if what that would look like or if what's going to happen, you know, if the Senate doesn't go along? We'll just be in this holding pattern again.
Well, yes, I've heard Senator Moreno's statements. It's hard to know from Columbus just how serious is a plan versus is this a face-saving move. But I think the politics here are kind of important in that, especially if you believe that the Senate isn't going to do anything, these congressmen all represent constituents who have just gotten – I mean, it's hard to overstate how big these premium jumps are. Like, imagine that your monthly premiums for healthcare just going up fourfold, fivefold, or – being so high that I'm just not going to have health insurance and I'm just going to absorb this huge risk of being uninsured. That's just like a very I think anyone who's uninsured that weighs heavily in your mind, you know who did that to you. And so I'm somewhat unsurprised. That's just a pretty naked political issue. That's a pretty naked political pain point in that you can see here's a very direct change to my material well-being. And Congress just voted, you know, a party line Republican vote would make it very easy for voters to say there's not a single Republican in Congress who doesn't want this specific thing to mm-hmm. happen to my specific healthcare premium. So I'm actually not surprised. I believe it's 17 Republicans Trump ship, which is which is a lot when most bills in Congress pass either unanimously or on party lines.
Yeah, 17 House Republicans joined the Democrats to extend the subsidies for 3 years.
And not to get too much into the politics of it all, but of course it's an election year and everyone in the U.S. House is up for re-election versus it's only like a third of the U.S. Senate. So there's definitely different approaches. And you see even in the Senate race here, like, I mean, Sherrod Brown has been talking about healthcare, like pretty much every press release I get from Sherrod Brown's team is about healthcare. So Democrats see this as a winning issue. It's something that is materially affecting people, like Jake said. So I'm not going to be surprised if more people end up, you know, trying to find a bipartisan compromise. But only time will tell.
And then it's worth noting of those 17, three were from Ohio, Max Miller, Dave Joyce, Mike Carey, particularly Max Miller and Mike Carey are in slightly more competitive districts in Ohio, where you would have both Republicans and Democrats. And a lot of their statements, and I'm pulling these from the great reporting of Cleveland.com, Sabrina Eden, were things like, you know, we support these short-term extensions as a bridge because they don't want to pull the rug out from under Ohioans. Like, you don't want to, it's very hard to take something that people like and rely on, rip it out in an election year.
Moving on before we have to take a break, Ohio has its first confirmed case of the measles for 2026. It's in Cuyahoga County, and it's being called an outbreak, but my understanding is it's three children all from the same household. But that, Jesse, that's how they define an outbreak. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think that just meets like the technical definition of an outbreak, whereas I think maybe in your mind, that's like a gazillion cases.
Yeah,
a technical term being gazillion. yes. And they said that the three children were not vaccinated, was my understanding. And really, the Department of Health is just saying that this is underlines the importance of being fully vaccinated. And this disease can be very serious and it is preventable. It's worth noting, I think, even with this proposed scaling back of childhood vaccinations, that measles is still on the list of 11 conditions that even the federal government would recommend to be vaccinated against.
Ohio had 45 measles cases last year in 2025. And there's also the issue right now, which Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, with the Department of Health here in Ohio, has been talking about a lot. More Ohioans are being hospitalized for the flu this year than this time last year. There's a new flu variant. It's being called the super flu. And Dr. Vanderhoff is urging Ohioans to get the flu vaccine, saying we all have very little immunity as a population, and it's allowing this strain to spread quickly.
Now, it's not very good at protecting us necessarily from contracting the flu in the first place. But it appears nevertheless to still be good at helping to prevent your flu illness from becoming very severe and potentially landing you in the hospital.
So I'm not sure if any of you covered Dr. Vanderhoff and him talking about the flu, but he does seem a little worried about this flu strain. Jake, you, no?
I did not cover it. I mean, that's... That's what epidemiologists do. They worry about infectious disease spreads.
Yeah.
And I think he's recommending particularly those who are the most vulnerable, so including children under the age of 11 and adults 65 and older. And I think we know just from history and understanding of the flu that those are particularly demographics that can be susceptible to these strains. So, yeah, I think he's kind of raising the alarm about this rise.
Well, coming up on the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, we're going to talk about daycares and fraud allegations, and we're going to also talk about data centers. That is when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And still with us, we have Jesse Ballmert, state, government, and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Jesse, in December, you wrote about the cost of daycare in Ohio and how the costs are rising. And you found that Ohio is one of only six states that does not spend state money on childcare beyond what is required. Can you expand on that a little more? Give us an overview of what you found about these childcare costs.
Yeah, I think it's something that anyone with children who's been in the childcare system or has worked as a childcare provider just intrinsically knows is that childcare is expensive and it's getting more expensive. And one of the ways that some other states have tried to help with this is by offsetting the costs in a variety of ways, whether that be putting some money towards childcare that maybe the business or their employer also chips in on. Kentucky has an innovative proposal where they provide childcare for childcare workers. Other states make publicly funded childcare more accessible. Ohio has one of the lowest rates to apply for publicly funded childcare in the country. Now they've shored that up a bit with some voucher money, but that is one-time kind of federal money that is going to disappear. And so groups like Groundwork Ohio, which advocate for child issues, say that we're facing a $600 million shortfall in the next state budget for childcare spending in Ohio. So we're, you know, in an interesting spot.
Wait, how much of a shortfall?
About $600 million.
That number sounds familiar. I believe that's the same number of unclaimed funds that we're using to build the Browns Stadium. Funny.
That is a connection that you can make. And somehow
I'm making that connection. All right, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, not Jesse. I did.
Yeah, no. Budgets are about choices, and this was a choice that we made in the last budget cycle. And so I talked to a lot of people just about why this is an issue that everyone agrees is a problem. Like, you have Democrats and Republicans putting forward solutions on this, and yet a lot of the solutions involve money, and just the desire to spend money on childcare in Ohio hasn't kept pace with some of these other priorities.
So why is it so hard for lawmakers to get on board? I mean, you just said that business leaders say that it's a factor in recruiting and retaining workers. I mean, that they're having trouble keeping workers. And,
Yeah. And
you know, lawmakers love workers to be working.
That has been a really interesting shift in just the conversation around childcare recently. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has really made this like an important point in their in just like their lobbying efforts, that we need to improve childcare access if we want to get especially more women, but just people generally into the workforce. You have places like, you know, Intel or Meta or so forth, like adding jobs, but are we going to be able to sustain that job growth without more people in the workforce? I think it comes down to a variety of issues. Number one, it is expensive. Governor DeWine proposed a child tax credit in the last budget, paid for with tobacco funding, and that did not pass. People were not excited about that funding source.
We couldn't even tax smoking. My goodness.
Other factors are, I think there might be a misunderstanding about how expensive childcare is. If maybe you had kids 20 years ago, that might not line up. For even a smaller group of people, there is a thought that either women or a parent should be staying home with the child, and that childcare is, you know, kind of against that. So there's a lot of ways that you get there, but I think largely the price tag is the biggest stumbling block for many people.
All right. So you wrote that story long before all of these fraud conversations happened. This is an issue that came up after your story happened, but it does pertain. So we're going to is it possible, Sarah, you were working on this and so was Jake, is fraud any part of why costs for childcare are so high?
I don't want to draw any sort of a conclusion like that because, you know, no one within state government has said there are like mass amounts of widespread fraud in Ohio. Governor DeWine called a press conference to basically debunk that idea. Mm-hmm. And I think off the bat should be noted that these fraud allegations started in Minnesota, were directed at the Somali American community in Minnesota because of a case, a benefits fraud scheme case that, you know, I think 50 or 60 people have been either indicted or found guilty. I obviously have not followed
convicted.
This case. Convicted. Thank you, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this case in Minnesota that's true. Right-wing influencers have taken that and started showing up at the doors of any daycare that's owned by Somali Americans. Columbus has the second largest population of Somali Americans, so that kind of spread here. So these fraud allegations, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who are talking generally about fraud. They're wanting to put a spotlight on fraud. Governor DeWine has said, you know, there is fraud. There's fraud in every benefit system. That's not to say that there's widespread fraud that is driving the cost up, because, of course, the state audits these sorts of things. But there is a lot of blame being directed at immigrants and the Somali American community in particular.
And you attended a press conference with the Ohio Department of Children and Youth director. Is it Kara Wente? Is it Wente? Mm-hmm. Okay. What did Kara Wente have to say about this fraud and these influencers going and knocking on doors of daycares?
Well, again, you know, Minnesota and Ohio are different states. They have different ways of you know, tackling how to publicly or how to distribute funds, how to audit daycare centers. In Ohio, Governor DeWine and also Director Wente said, you know, when you drop your kid off at daycare, you have to put in like a PIN, like a personal identification number. You're scanned by photo. Ohio pays publicly funded childcare, because even though a lot of this money is coming from the federal government, it's being administered and distributed by the state. Ohio pays these daycares based on attendance, not enrollment. So versus the number of kids who are just generally enrolled in the daycare, Ohio pays based on kids actually being signed into the daycare. So DeWine argues that there are things in place to ensure that there is not widespread fraud. But of course, again, you do have these claims and these videos that have been circulating online that are just trying to find like any discrepancies.
Jake, you wrote about this as well, but why are politicians seizing on this issue so much?
Yeah, well, so these prosecutions, this Minnesota case, go back to 2022, but the whole thing really came to a head in late December when a YouTuber named Nick Shirley put out about a 40-minute video online, and there were some political connections between Nick and a man who only went by his first name who appeared in this video knocking on the doors of these allegedly empty daycares. But so there was a very political way about this video. And this video kind of exploded. It went viral online. And something I'd add to put a fine point on this, there's nobody in Ohio politics who has credibly put forward evidence to suggest that there is a fraud problem in daycares. All that has happened is, to name some names here, Josh Williams, a House representative, Keith Faber, the state auditor. Keith Faber's is pretty indicative. He wrote a letter in the Columbus Dispatch. He issued a news release saying, because of the public discourse around possible fraud, we're launching an audit and we're seeking investigation. So, and Josh Williams' letter he wrote on the subject uses similar language, sort of, because many people are talking about this and it has this effect, whether intentionally or not, of getting words like fraud, Somalia, daycare into headlines, and it creates this sort of cloud that something improper has happened. And Governor DeWine held this press conference that Sarah talked about, where he was emphatic, and him and Kara Wente were emphatic, that there's no fraud. We have these controls in place. We hold audits. You know, we find some fraud, but there's no evidence of a scaled problem within the system. You're going to have an error rate in any big public fund system. The interesting thing to me was that Governor DeWine was absolutely unwilling to grapple with where is this stuff coming from. I mean, me and my colleagues asked him 10 different ways to Sunday, why do people think that there's fraud in daycares? Why are they knocking on doors, you know, demanding answers? And he said, look, I'm not going there. I mean, he was pretty adamant. I understand what you're asking, and I'm just not going to answer the question. And I got a chance to ask him. I said, the last time I remember you executing this public and firm of a fact check was when people were claiming that Haitians, another minority group present in Ohio, were eating people's dogs and cats, a plainly racially loaded claim. And Governor DeWine penned an op-ed in the New York Times saying that's not true. Me, I personally saw two very obvious similarities between the two, and I asked Governor DeWine if he saw the same, and he said, I'm not going to comment on that. So Governor DeWine is adamant to correct the record, but he is unwilling to come out and say, who is distorting that record in the first place.
And I did follow up with him like 2 days after the press conference and asked him just like generally about safety concerns for Somali Americans, because I talked to Representative Ismail Mohammed, who is one of two Somali Americans elected to the Ohio legislature. His daughter goes to an area daycare in Columbus. Like, he said he feels very concerned. And DeWine told me, you know, once someone's here, once someone is a U.S. citizen, they're a U.S. citizen. You know, he did, you know, he said, if you look at the Somali population, they came here decades ago. In some cases, they started businesses. They've done many, many things. So we need to treat people as individuals, not as a group. Again, comments that are reminiscent of what he was saying in this situation with Haitians in Springfield, and Haitian Americans, who, of course, their TPS status is ending in February. So I'm sure we'll be talking about all this again next month. But these rumors and these allegations that are being spread by right-wing influencers, it's very interesting because they come across politicians' desks and then they become part of the conversation. You know, Vice President J.D. Vance, another very notable Buckeye State native who is in a very high position of power, said from the White House about child care, those programs should go to American citizens, not be defrauded by Somali immigrants and others. So, you know, it has gone to the level of the White House is saying that, you know, Somali Americans are the ones committing this fraud.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you to Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
And this has been the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.